Tonight on Community Air, we hear from four powerful speakers who gave the talk of their life in 15 minutes or less at a recent Stand Up Stories event held by the Clatsop County Democrats. John Orr is an attorney and musician who recently moved to Portland, and he'll talk about the importance of activism. Margaret Frimuth is the director of the Lives in Transition program at Clatsop Community College. Her talk was entitled, I Do, Do You? And it's on marriage equality. Josh Marquis is the Clatsop County District Attorney, and he'll talk about access or lack of access to mental health resources in Clatsop County. Our first speaker is Greg Delgado. Greg drove all the way to Astoria from Bend, Oregon, where he's a community outreach activist for Oregon's immigrants' rights organization, CAUSA. Here's Greg Delgado.
First, I'm going to start a little bit with my story, and then I'm going to give a local story, and then we'll move from there. But I'm from Southern Arizona myself. The issue, I'm going to speak on immigration and the driver card and our Latino communities here in Oregon. We're one of the fastest growing communities in the state, so I'm very proud to say that we're going to be everywhere and we're moving forward. Originally, I'm from Southern Arizona, where the border issue and the immigration issue was on a daily, where you heard the stories of the people, the death in the border, where you see the people crossing on a daily basis. Even before that, my grandfather and we were all from the Southern Arizona region. Latino, Native American. Very proud to be Yaqui, Apache, and Latino at the same time, and American as well. So, and I remember the stories from my grandfather telling us when he would walk through the desert from Nogales to Tucson barefoot because he didn't want to dirty his shoes to go to the dance. I remember the stories from how they used to carry trade across those borders. Nowadays, it's not the same. That border has changed. It is a military industrial complex with a big, huge fence and helicopters and you have it all there. So it's a whole different story now than it was back in the day of my grandfather. So. But the reason I'm bringing that up is because this story that happened to me in Bend was I was working in a kitchen in Bend, and this is kind of an aha moment for myself. There was a group of people on the line in the kitchen. I was cooking there, and I'd been in this restaurant for about 3 years. And this young man walks up in the kitchen, and he just got out of culinary school, and he says, if I ever open a kitchen, I'm going to hire all Mexicans because I can pay them less and they work harder. And everybody thought that was cool. And they was like, yeah, you know, it was very fine. And I had that moment. I was like, really? I've been here 3 years and this is what I'm going to hear. And yes, I was making less. I was actually cleaning toilets and mopping floors to earn extra income because I wasn't getting paid enough there. And then I thought, this is not an immigration issue. This is not a Mexican issue. This is how we as a community and as a society treat each other and how we look at each other. You know, I'm a third, fourth generation American here, and I'm very proud to say that. So that made me realize we have to make some kind of change. That was my last kitchen job, just to let you know. That's when I became an activist. So, and then after that, thank you. So after that, the other story is a young family, the Tapia family. Liliana Ramos has three children. She was undocumented. Her three children are born in the U.S., Now, these three children were in Bend in high school and junior high. And one day, she was a supervisor at a local hotel there. The immigration office came, and they actually went with three Suburbans to her work and picked her up and took her. And nobody knew what happened to her. Her kids called me crying, concerned, couldn't find their mother. We later found out that the mother had been deported. She was in a deportation process. She was a single mother, and in the past, her husband and her had separated, but he had started an asylum process, so they gave her a temporary social. Well, she just did what she could to survive and to raise her family until that one day they came and abducted her. That's exactly what they did. Nobody knew what happened to this poor woman. The three children were left there. So at that moment, this family's life has changed also. These three U.S.-born children, when she said, my children are U.S.-born, what do I do with my children? The Border Patrol, the ICE customs people said, take them with you. So this is our U.S. government telling them, take U.S. children from this country and take them away from here. So it was a very scary moment for them. Now, at that moment, all these kids' lives have changed. Her life has changed. Obviously, she's deported. She's in Tijuana now, living by herself over there. And oddly enough, something amazing has happened. She, out of her misery, has created a support group and also a shelter for women facing the same issue. It turned out that in Tijuana, I went to go visit her over there. There are hundreds and hundreds of women facing the same issue. They're deported and their children on this side. And many are being adopted out because after 60 days, it's a child abandonment issue. So there's a lot of this. So to help herself, she's helping other people over there. But the other issue is her three children in the United States now. One of them just graduated high school, who almost did not graduate high school because she was so depressed and so angry. She struggled through high school, but we got her counseling, and we were there for her as a community. We worked together to help her, support her through that. Her son, the eldest, he just turned 21. We're looking to get her to try to get a deport, get her back through him as an adult now. But the fact is, both of their lives have changed. No more dreams of college. No more dreams of a childhood. It's all gone. They are now struggling just to get their mother, support the mother in Mexico. She has a job, but they have to support her because the income that she has over there barely enough to subside on. So they're struggling now. Their lives have changed completely. And the reason I bring the two stories up is because the thing we have in common, we are all Americans. We all are Americans, but these stories have so many different sides to them, and it changes lives everywhere. So the point of the stories is we have to learn to respect one another regardless of our citizenship. I think we have to work together more as a community. The Ramos family was a big story on how the community came out and supported them. We did fundraisers to help get the attorney's fees, and they actually were able to get her to stay to get her process delayed a while so she can get her affairs in order. But this brought a community together to understand, and a faith-based community and a whole community say, this isn't about immigration. This isn't about papers. This is how we treat each other. This is how we look at each other. Immigration, the Latino issue is one, but there's so many aspects to immigration right now. It's a global issue, and we have immigration from all over the world. And how are we going to look at that in the future? We did in the past with NAFTA. That created a lot of this issue. And now we're coming across with the Pacific Free Trade Agreement, another one. What is that going to look like? Is that going to create millions, 20 more million? Or are they, like they said, on steroids of more immigration to our country? Well, how do we address that? And how do we look at each other, one another, as neighbors? And how do we build communities? And like the gentleman just said, it was up here. How do we work together as a community to create a community and envision the community we want to live in? So we got to work together to find those kinds of solutions. And it starts one community at a time. And we've been working really hard to do a lot around that in our community of Central Oregon. But I think Oregon is a great breeding ground for that kind of reality. People here learn to love and respect one another and how to build a strong community. And we got to put that forward and bring that message to the nation as a whole. And one of the other things I wanted to mention today also is about Oregon driver card, which falls into this too. 80,000 people in Oregon lost a driver card to the signature. They tied it to the Social Security card. It was a driving issue. It's a public safety issue, and they tied it to a social. So now 80,000 people that were driving, taking their kids to school, going to work, are now without a driver card because they don't have a path to citizenship. We make this path to citizenship impossible. We don't give them a driver card, and we just leave them in our communities. This process is antiquated, and it's backwards, and we need to find changes for that. But there are some amazing things that have happened. CAUSA and many other coalition of organizations worked together for 3 years to fight for the driver card. We last year in May, our governor signed it on the steps of the Capitol into law with a bipartisan support to pass this law. Now, unfortunately, right after that, the next day, there was a petition signed, sent in, and it went to a referendum. So just to let you know, the money for that referendum came from out of state. It came from somebody working on one of the opposition parties funded the referendum, and it's going to go to vote in November. But this is a public safety issue. It's not just about a Latino issue, and it's about a neighborhood issue. We as communities have to learn how to work together and how to come up with a solution that respects all of us and our communities, because I'm looking at communities like Bend and Hermiston in Ontario that are 30 and 40% Latino these days. We have a lot of Latinos in our communities. We're growing. We're building communities. We're starting businesses, building families. And so how do we make that all work together? And it's not about, can we just take one person out of that community that has no papers? Because we're mixed status, okay? And that's not just the undocumented people. We have over 200,000 in our state alone. But that doesn't include children and U.S.-born citizens also that are Latinos. So we have a lot of culture in our communities. We need to learn how to embrace that instead of push it away or look at it in that fear thing that people look at through, that lens. I think we just have to kind of have the conversations and learn how to work together to find solutions. And that's pretty much what I wanted to say today. Thank you.
And that was Greg Delgado. He's a community outreach activist with CAUSA, Oregon's immigrant rights organization, and he came to Astoria from Bend. You're listening to Coast Community Radio, KMUN and KTCB. And tonight on Community Air, a selection of four powerful speakers from a recent event held by the Clatsop County Democrats. It was called Stand Up Stories. Next, we're going to hear from Margaret Frimuth. Margaret is director of the Lives in Transition program at Clatsop Community College, and her issue is marriage equality. Here's Margaret Frimuth.
When I was in fifth grade, my teacher, Mr. Bob Butler, discussed fractions by telling us that there was no such thing as a bigger half. Half was an equal division of a whole. Mr. Butler emphasized this by suggesting that when sharing that last piece of delicious cherry pie with a sibling, one child should cut the piece in half and the other get to choose, thus ensuring equality. This was a lifelong lesson to me. This afternoon, I want to take some other snippets of my life, important parts of the topic, not just of the legalities of marriage equality, but the broader look through a quantitative research lens at the lived experiences and importance of marriage equality and equality. The name Catherine Lee Bates may be familiar to some. She's most widely known for writing the poem America the Beautiful, and recently the name was in the news due to the use of the song America the Beautiful in a commercial sung in many languages and played during this year's Super Bowl. The news chatter wasn't about her writing ability, though, but about her life with another woman. Let me expand the political banter a bit and tell you about Catherine Lee Bates and her partner of 25 years, Catherine Coleman. Both were professional scholars. Both were prolific writers. At the turn of the 20th century, the women lived together in what was described as a Boston marriage. Although some dispute and even scrutinize the term Boston marriage as synonymous with a lesbian relationship, well, I'm going to let you decide that after hearing a snippet from a poem that Bates dedicated to Coleman after her tragic death in 1915 to the much hushed disease of breast cancer. The poem titled Yellow Clover recalls Bates walking in the woods with Coleman and chancing upon a patch of yellow clover. She writes, "How suddenly we halted in our climb, lingering, reluctant up that farthest hill, stooped for the blossoms closest to our feet, and gave them as a token, each to each, in lieu of speech." Later in the poem, she refers to the yellow clover as our tenderest language, inferring a secretive language about a love that was not socially acceptable. She writes about scheming to surprise each other throughout the summer with these gifts of homely flowers. And the poem ends with a description of Bates' grief at the loss of her beloved partner. "From each of us to each, so that our hearts might reach and touch within the yellow clover love's letter to be glad about, like sunshine when it came. My sorrow asks no healing. It is love. Let love then make me brave to bear the keen hurts of this careless summertide. I of our own poor flower changed with our fatal hour. For all its sunshine vanished when you died. Only..." Gets me every time. "Only white clover blossoms on your grave." Thanks. Remembering the lives of Catherine Lee Bates and Catherine Coleman is a symbolic remembering of a time in our history when women married women, and the society did not collapse. In fact, we are enriched by their gifts. 31 years ago today, more or less, Fred Small, an attorney turned singer-songwriter, turned Universal Unitarian minister, wrote a song for a musician friend named Janet Peterson. Some of you may know her from the musical group here in the Northwest called Motherlode. Janet was craving an honest, inclusive song that she could sing to her 9-year-old son. Fred Small penned the introductory lines, simply describing a typical evening family ritual. We've cleared off the table, the leftovers saved, washed the dishes, and put them away. Then he sets the stage for a different type of lullaby when he sings, "As the moon sets its sail to carry you to sleep, I will sing you a song no one sang to me." By singing the words that were not taught but discovered, Fred Small makes visible the frequent invisibility of non-traditional families. In addition, he transcends gender stereotypes as he sings about girls who grow up strong and bold and boys who are gentle and kind. He defines inclusive relationships while acknowledging the many dimensions of families. Some women love women. Some men love men. Some raise children. Some never do. In the musical bridge, he warns of taunts and name-calling, while encouraging us to seek out spirits true and dream of everything possible. Ultimately, his song is grounded in the words that begin the chorus, "You can be anybody you want to be. You can love whomever you will." Over the past 3 decades, the song "Everything Possible" has become a standard for queer families. It's often used at PFLAG meetings and sung to honor loving relationships and their vast dimensions. I think it's also in the Unitarian Church songbook these days, too. Interesting, tonight in Los Angeles, past San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom is hosting a 10-year anniversary party commemorating his February 12, 2004 proclamation in support of same-sex weddings. The first two people in line to get married in San Francisco are two of my heroes, Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon. At that time, they'd been partners for over 50 years. In 1955, they founded the first lesbian organization in the country, the Daughters of Bilitis. They also published a monthly magazine called The Ladder, giving voice and visibility to lesbian relationships. Their lives revolved around community engagement. I learned of Del Martin after she published the 1976 groundbreaking book, Battered Wives. Del Martin, a lesbian activist working to ensure safety for married women and the elimination of violence for all people. Their 2004 marriage was, of course, rescinded 6 months later. However, a 2008 Supreme Court decision gave Gavin Newsom the right to remarry the couple, which he did, just 2 months before Del Martin's death. She was 87 years old. On a much more personal note, today, 10 years ago, I stood in line. I'm so emotional today. I stood in line. And a long line that circled around the outside of the Multnomah County Courthouse waiting to get a marriage license. 10 years ago tomorrow, this was a marriage put together in 24 hours, my partner and I were officially married. Of course, a few months later, we received a letter stating that we were no longer married. However, that's not shaken the 26 years of love that we continue to share. Thanks, Sharon. So what do these stories have in common, not only with lesbian lives, but also with the lives of people we call immigrants, people in workplaces that are unfair. Well, the stories I shared have to do with love, for sure. In fact, these stories represent the enduring tenacity of love despite silencing, scrutiny, judgment, discrediting relationships, shame, isolation, taunting, name-calling, the ever-present possibility of violence, and the seemingly unending waves of discrimination. I think both of you could say the same. This is a key point to understanding all forms of oppression and provides a glimpse down a path to a healthier society. You see, I do not believe that marriage equality is a stand-alone issue. It is interconnected to an invisible landscape of social and cultural expectations, learned expectations, not innate tendencies. Human beings are not historically or neurologically hardwired specifically or exclusively for heterosexual relationships or for hatred. We are not hardwired to be violent. We are not hardwired to be oppressive. These are all learned, socially defined constructs. I'm sure that some of you have heard that humans are violent by nature. That's a justification. It's a good one, too. It works, doesn't it? There's not proof. In fact, there's a lineage of knowledge that documents humanity very differently. The documentation has recently been correlated with MRI brain scans linking high-level brain activity when humans express the capacity for connectedness, love, and compassion. One of my mentors, social scientist and activist Dr. Rian Eisler, spent years researching the entirety of human history, including prehistory, to glean information about human behaviors. In essence, and this is a very brief essence, she discovered three key findings that influence our base of knowledge about oppression on the one hand and equality on the other. One, by reviewing ancient art and archaeology, not just relying on recent written history, but going back further, she found clear evidence of a more peaceful time of societies where there were tools lacking of implements of war and domination. Within these early societies, there was documentation about egalitarianism in the social structure. Art showed a sharing of daily routines, family, and social lives. Differences in social welfare and wealth and gender expectations were not excessive. And three, there was no evidence in paintings, weavings, ritual artifacts, burial gifts, and temple relics to suggest that women were subordinate to men. In fact, there was greater evidence that women played critical and important roles in the social, religious, and governmental structures without indications that men were oppressed by powerful women. In other words, it wasn't the inverse of domination, of male domination. It was different. Remember Bob Butler, Equal is Equal? So this is an extremely simple overview of the vast data that Eisler spent years deciphering. Ultimately, she developed a theory that defined two very different social structures, one that links healthy society to the markings of partnership, while the other is defined by the support and pursuit and maintenance of domination. Both ends of the continuum are part of our human condition. The issue of marriage equality requires us to assess our place on that ever-changing continuum between domination and partnership. Once we see that continuum, we can focus beyond the single issue of marriage and marriage equality and step towards a more holistic quest for partnership-based community, a community that lets go of discrimination based on gender or sexual orientation or immigration status or race or socioeconomic status or any number of other divisions. We can visualize a framework that supports gender equity, strong families, and healthy communities. Healthy, diverse communities. And so we come full circle back to Mr. Butler and my fifth grade class. We are completely capable of sharing equitably. Because we align ourselves with partnership ideologies, we can connect to our deepest and most powerful definition of our humanness, which is love. Within that paradigm of partnership, we can all sing. You can be anybody you want to be. You can love whomever you will. You can travel any country where your heart leads and know, I will love you still. You can gather friends around. You can choose one special one. You think I'm out of time? And the only measure of your words and your deeds will be the love you leave behind when you're gone. Thank you very much.
Margaret Frimuth, Director of the Lives in Transition Program at Clatsop Community College, spoke at the Stand Up Stories event presented by the Clatsop County Democrats. You're listening to Community Air on Coast Community Radio, KMUN 91.9, KTCB 89.5, and coming to you on the web, wherever you are at coastradio.org, also on your mobile apps on TuneIn Radio. And tonight we're playing a selection of speakers from the Stand Up Stories event. Next weekend, next Sunday at this time, four more speakers from the Stand Up Stories event here on Community Air. Coming up next, Josh Marquis. Josh is the Clatsop County District Attorney, and he's going to tell us about access to mental health.
And today has some significance for me because 28 years ago today, Governor Roberts appointed me to this job. So special. Now, after some of that uplifting stuff you've just heard, this may be a little bit of a downer. I want to start off by admitting that there is no such thing as normal. Each of us can be placed on a broad spectrum, different one than Margaret talked about, that ranges in psychological terms from being so well-adjusted you are like the Dalai Lama, which I think is what we all aspire to, all the way to people whose brains give what we call command hallucinations, which tell them to do violent and often scary things to themselves and other people, or severe autism, other things along the scale of what we call mental illness. Now, the vast majority of us fall somewhere along that continuum. And before we label people as mentally ill, we need to understand that we all have our quirks, many of which are described in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual 4R, revised, which is the cookbook used by psychiatrists, psychologists, and therapists to diagnose everything from eating disorders to depression to antisocial personality and the more common early onset adult schizophrenia. At the risk of branding myself crazy, a fairly meaningless term, which has no real significance in either the medical or legal communities, I want to tell you a little story about when I started in the field I'm in the early 1970s. I worked in the DA's office in Eugene, and they thought it would be a good idea to start testing cops for their psychological well-being to make sure that you just didn't get the high school bullies as cops, which in some communities was a problem. So they gave a test called the MMPI. Some of you may be familiar with it. It means Minnesota Multiphase Personality Inventory. It's about 500-600 true-false questions. And it asks their validity scales to see if the person's malingering. And it tests things like paranoia, psychopathic personality, depression, hypomania. So after the score of the test, the shrink looks at me and kind of arches his eyebrows and says, well, you're pretty high on the hypomania scale, and you do have a few aspects of OCD, but don't worry, you're not mentally ill. My point is that for many of us, the very things that give us drive, passion, or creativity may also be viewed in a cold clinical light as a deviation from normality. One of the problems with the MMPI is it's often given to people in jails, and the classic questions that usually trigger paranoia are things like, I smell strange smells. People are looking at me all the time. People are listening to me. Well, guess what? When you're in jail, you do smell strange smells. People are looking at you. We are after you. So they're really not paranoid. So it's very important to note that the psychiatric profession clearly distinguishes from two radically different kinds of mental illnesses. Thought disorders, which are generally treatable, and personality disorders, which are generally not. Those are the people, I'm not going to talk there much about them Those are antisocial, narcissistic. Generally, you ask a psychiatrist, what's the treatment for that? The answer is none. But there are treatments for thought disorder. Now, we live in a remarkably free society in Oregon where there's an appropriately very high standard for the involuntary commitment of people. And usually what happens is family members come, they are at the end of their rope, and they say, we need help. In Oregon, in order for someone to be mentally committed, they must, one, be chronically mentally ill, and have one of the three following characteristics: be an imminent danger to themselves, an imminent danger to others, or unable to care for their basic needs. Now, this doesn't mean bad eating habits like the ones Cindy thinks I have, which are probably in the long term not good for my basic needs. And it doesn't mean that at some point, maybe 2-3 weeks ago, the person, it means right now. So if that doesn't happen, the judge is not going to be able to commit that person. And yet, I watch with small degree of sadness as I watch the sheriff's office chain people up, just like you would somebody accused of murder, and take them from Astoria to the nearest psychiatric bed, which is often in Ontario, Oregon. So they're going to drive 7 hours chained up from here to there and then back. I can't believe that's good for anybody. Now, the mere fact that someone's clothing, hygiene, even behavior is unusual or really bothers people is not and should not be the basis for commitment. And we all, some of the greatest artists in the world, were odd to the point of sometimes, you know, actually being self-destructive. Nobody wants to see anybody commit suicide. Although it is often very difficult to intervene in the slower methods of self-destruction, such as the growing curse of heroin addiction in both Clatsop County and Oregon. But the mere fact that someone's an addict is not a basis for committing them. So what can we do? What should we do for people whose mental orders place them at risk? Now that we've established that we all fall somewhere in that continuum, I prosecute hundreds of criminals every year. A good 75% of them suffer from severe substance abuse disorders. Some of them are what are called dual diagnosis. They have an underlying mental disease of some degree or another compounded by a substance abuse. I don't think, however, that the mentally ill commit crimes at any greater proportion than the so-called general population. So the mere fact that somebody is bipolar does not mean that they're predisposed to commit crimes. A woman, however, is standing naked in driving rain out here on Marine in the middle of and swinging at cars at night. The police are going to have to take that person into custody. And where are they going to take them? There's only one place to take them in here, in this county, to jail, which is not a good place for anybody. The officers generally record all of their encounters now with these little lapel cameras, so we know exactly what happened. And I have to say, I am really moved by the compassion that I've seen a lot of these officers show for people who are, frankly, floridly psychotic. But jail is a poor substitute for other facilities, virtually none of which exist in our community. Despite people like, and I'm looking right at her, Juanita Price, or she's right there, her thing's back there, the indefatigable head of the National Alliance for Mentally Ill here in Clatsop County. And the professionals at the ER and the people at Clatsop Behavioral House. So how do we balance the civil rights of all citizens, even those with profound disorders, with the idea that we want to protect people from and not allow them to literally die on our streets? Well, one of the advantages to living in a smaller community is there aren't 6 degrees of separation, more like 2. And what I mean by that is somebody will come up to me in the post office and start telling me this heartbreaking story about how they've tried everything and they've called all these people and all they get is voicemail. They find the services are lacking. They're concerned their father, their son, their niece, their daughter, their loved one, their partner is going to die without intervention. They're convinced of that. And I have to be honest with them and tell them, look, the best possible legal scenario is an involuntary commitment to the Oregon Health Authority. And what does that mean? That means that they will hold you up to 6 months, and they will pump you full of antipsychotic drugs, which have some really nasty long-term side effects. And as far as I can tell, I will read the psychiatric records, and they'll say milieu therapy, which as best I can tell means they stick them in a room with a bunch of other profoundly mentally ill people and a television set and some board games, and they milieu around together, literally. Dr. Sharon Mirnan, who is a ER doctor in Portland, wrote a really interesting op-ed that you can still get online in last Sunday's Oregonian, decrying the practice of boarding psychiatric patients in ERs. Now, and her point was it's cruel, there's nobody looking after them, they're not getting treatment, She's right, of course. The difference is in Clatsop County, we don't even get to put them in an emergency room because we have no safe rooms, none. Two hospitals, zero safe rooms. Now, I'll be blunt. The reason is the hospitals don't want them. Emergency room doctors want to treat people, triage them, and frankly, a crazy, violent, dangerous person flailing around is going to disrupt that. So they just say, look, we want them somewhere else. Now, the historical basis for this miserable commentary is American social engineering. There were snake pits. Anybody who ever saw Frederick Wiseman's wonderful thing called Titicut Follies, which was an amazing documentary about a Massachusetts mental hospital, or saw the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, actually filmed at the old Oregon State Hospital, and the doctor that interviews Jack Nicholson was Dr. Dean Brooks, who was the actual head, just died a few weeks ago. Nice man. The result, though, that was the horror at all this says, well, let's deinstitutionalize. And this went everybody, and frankly, this is Republicans and Democrats both. Reagan started this when he was governor of California, but Democrats, frankly, adopted it on a different level, saying, we'll have community supervision. We'll shut down these snake pits. We'll put them out in the community where there will be halfway houses. Well, guess what happened? We just dumped them out in the street. We have people, again, command hallucinations of things that order you to do something. Now, some might argue that the freedom to live under a bridge is a lifestyle choice. And I suppose that is, but many are prisoners of their own illness, unable to get any access to medication or therapy. And I frankly get pretty pissed when I see in Portland where they seem to sort of celebrate homelessness with the fact that most of those people, or many of them, are children, drug addicted, living in enormously deplorable conditions where they're going to be sexually exploited and injured. And I suppose everyone has a right to live under a bridge, but most of us are probably not going to choose that if we have a chance. I'm often cross-examining experts because I can't afford them, so I have to cross-examine them. And I'm told I'm an overly concrete thinker, which is not meant as a compliment, by the way. It's actually a claim that I'm slightly, you know, mentally ill. But I'm concrete in the sense I want to know, what do we do here in Clatsop County? What can we do? We have one psychiatrist, MD, who's part-time. The county has for many years outsourced this mental health program to a Portland-based outfit called Clatsop Behavioral Health. I work with many of their workers. They're underpaid. They're overworked. A couple years ago, we had dedicated housing in Uniontown. That's been closed down. We have Open Door. The theory is people can come in, get their medications maintained. That's now operated on a peer-to-peer basis. That's just not good enough. So think globally, act locally. Here's what we need to do, and soon. We need one or two safe rooms in this county. Two, we need housing for people who are mentally ill, who can live independently with some assistance. But the big one is that the county needs to put some skin in the game, by which I mean money. Virtually all the money we spend is pass-through money. It's federal money and state money, many of which has come from the good Senator Johnson and our Ways and Means Committee. But guess what? If you look at the county budget, not one dime is our money, Clatsop County money. Now, I'm sure the county manager will not be happy to hear that, and he'll probably say to me, well, where do you want the money to come from? I have no idea. I'm not the county manager. But we, the county, its citizens, need to prioritize our response to this crisis. Frankly, we need to spend a few $100,000 of our county money, not just grant dollars, to hire locally based mental health professionals who I'm convinced live here. I've met some of them, both at the MSW level, maybe higher. This won't be cheap. I'm talking to people who live here, who know the community, who know the difference when I say, oh, they're living in Taylorville versus they're living in Gearhart. Most of you immediately know what I'm talking about. But if you don't live here, and you don't, that's not going to mean anything. This won't be cheap, no more so than the justice system, which never can be or should be a revenue center. We don't make money off of helping people get better or holding people accountable. And if we do, there's something seriously wrong with the problem. So we are currently, and this is not as upbeat as some of the other speakers, but we're failing people in this community, we're failing their families, and therefore we're failing our community. So things need to change. In early May, the County Budget Committee meets, attend, speak, advocate. It's often been said a society is measured by the way it treats its most vulnerable and most concerned citizens. I feel that way about animals. It's a completely different issue, but I think our hearts all go out in the same way. And I am part of that system, so I feel a sense of personal failure as well. every time I do one of these hearings, and you succeed in committing somebody, and I'm not sure we're really doing that much good for them. So this is wrong. We need to start turning it around. So my first suggestion is that you show up and convince our county commissioners that it's time, as I say, to put some skin in the game. Thank you very much.
Josh Markey, Clatsop County District Attorney, spoke at the Stand Up Stories event presented by the Clatsop County Democrats. You're listening to Coast Community Radio, KMUN 91.9 Astoria, KTCB 89.5 Tillamook, streaming live on the web at coastradio.org, and you can find us on your mobile apps on TuneIn Radio. Tonight on Community Air, we're playing a series of speakers, four powerful speakers from the Stand Up Stories event. Next Sunday at the same time at 7 o'clock, four more of the speakers. Coming up next is John Orr. John is an attorney and musician. He recently moved to Portland from Astoria, and he's been an activist for many years in the Democratic Party. Here's John Orr talking about the value of activism.
Just hear a few shout outs. What's if you could change the world with a wave of your hand, with a wave of a wand, what would you change? Just spray it out. Education, poverty, mental illness, what? No war. Okay. Well, you're fortunate. You've come to the right place to answer all the questions and solve all the problems. I want you to write something down. We the People Amendment.org. Write it down. No, I'm serious. You want to change the world. You said that. So now here's your opportunity. Because in my considered opinion, after being involved in politics and policy and studying economics and practicing law, this is the silver bullet for change. Let me say that again, in case you didn't hear it. This is the silver bullet for change. We the people. Why? I feel kind of emotional about this issue. Corporations are not people. They do not get constitutional rights. They do not deserve constitutional rights. So, I'm supposed to tell a story. August 21st, 1977, 2 days before my birthday. I didn't think I would be kind of doing the Merle Haggard thing, turned 21 in prison. It wasn't exactly a prison, it was a jail. Now I've got your attention. Well, I went to jail to stop the construction of a gymnasium. Now, if that's not idealism, I don't know what is. And this gymnasium happened to be located at the site of the Kent State Massacre of May 4th, 1970. So I was there at Kent State 7 years later. So we had meeting after meeting after meeting and demonstrations, and we filed papers. We went to federal district court in Cleveland, and we had Bill Kunstler, William Kunstler. Does anybody remember Bill Kunstler? Great man, great personal inspiration to me. My goal in life, and my life is not over, would be Bill Kunstler, to be a movement lawyer, power to the people, fight injustice. And so I got to meet him, and I got to do my first task of legal research at the University of Michigan Law Library for him in those days. So long story short, there's an injunction. We're not supposed to jump over the fence where they're going to build the gymnasium. I jump over the fence. I spent 5 days in the jail. I fast. Just imagine, you know, about 40 pounds lighter then. I got a ponytail. I got the red headband and everything. And I got out of jail. Yeah! They built a gymnasium. So there's a little bit of disillusionment. So I guess, what is activism? It's to be politically active. That's the way I define it. I didn't look it up in a dictionary. And why are we active? Because we care. Because we want to feel empowered to change the world, to make the world a better place. Is that sort of the consensus here? We're not into activism to make life better for corporations. We're not in it to increase their profits or to do any things there along those lines. We have corporations. I'll get to more of that. I do want to say one thing, though, to let you know why I am coming out of a period of not much activism into activism. Imagine 18 trains running every 24 hours with 120 cars, each one of those trains leaving approximately 10,500 pounds of coal dust and chunks in the Columbia Gorge, in the runoff, in the river, in the bodies of the water, into the lungs of children, elderly, asthmatics, and adults alike, causing all kinds of environmental ecologic havoc, disturbing the quality of life, delays of up to 15 minutes, delaying emergency vehicles, basically us being a conduit for basically game over for the planet as far as climate change is concerned. Have I got your attention now? This is real. It's not just coal trains, actually. It's barges, Panamax and Capesize, so big they have to go down around the Cape. Those are also being proposed at three ports. And so that issue has me up, and that's why I'm getting active. And if you want to get active, Columbia River Keeper and Sierra Club are involved in those issues. Yeah, support them. So when did I become an activist? Sixth grade, spring of 1968, Vietnam War, student unrest, military industrialization and going on in the campuses. And I was at Columbia on a vacation. Let's see, there are these things going on over there. And so I was really into the presidential politics, always have been. That was like 11 election cycles ago for the presidency. And Robert Kennedy seemed to be this, you know, wonderful, inspirational figure. And I went and saw him speak, and 2 months later he was dead. He was shot dead. And that kind of followed the part of my education in formative years is about violence and Kent State and Robert Kennedy's death and Martin Luther King's death. But it just seemed to me that there was a lot at stake because of what followed Robert Kennedy's death. And we had 8 years. Well, we had 5 years of Nixon, whatever it was. So basically, We the People Amendment says that artificial entities such as corporations do not have constitutional rights. That's Section 1, paraphrased. I'll put you to sleep probably if I read it, but it's at that website, We the People amendment.org. The second section says money is not free speech. This is all came about, although it is accumulation of 80 years of horrible law, inconsistent and mindless creation of corporation rights. There's nothing in the First Amendment or the 14th Amendment says a word about corporate rights. The 14th Amendment was created to give rights to slaves. There were corporations at the time of the founding, the fathers writing the Constitution. They did not have any ideas, nor did they want Constitution or the Bill of Rights to apply. And yet, because of the control of corporations and their political power and who they've put in place, namely Lewis Powell, he was a lawyer for the Chamber of Commerce, and he had this plan, and it's just been all manifested, and that was to make the law more friendly. You got to read this book. It's pretty readable, but if you really need a reason to see how kind of evil and nefarious and this growing influence of corporations, you know, they went in Portland, they want to put, you know, ads on school buses, you know, in corporations, you know, they're disturbing stories. I don't have time to go into them, right? You should read this, but they do sound an alarm bell to the extent that corporations are getting ahead of us in undermining representative democracy. I have 6 minutes left. Okay. So, in the aftermath of the Citizens United election, $126 million of anonymous corporate money flowed into the congressional elections. Didn't really help us govern, did it? I mean, me, myself, looking at the way Congress has conducted itself, I don't know if it's a linear relationship, but, the gates have fallen, and that seems to be the direction we're going, is dysfunctional government. The interests, the needs of the people, whether you're Republican or Democratic alike, this government is not working well. This Congress is not serving the people's interests. They're undermining our financial standing in the world community. They're having trouble passing infrastructure, needed infrastructure bills. They're having trouble passing the farm bill. And it's all just seems like it's going to shit, if you pardon the expression. So this is a way. This is a way to go after that and make a change, because that money, if it stops flowing, it's going to be a people's election. It's not going to be a corporation's election. Another anecdote would be appropriate here. Back in 1978, I was very much into solar energy. I was a student at the University of Michigan, and we had a solar day. And I remember one Saturday morning, we walked. We got up very early, very early. It was, the fuel. It was very cold. You could see our breath because the energy was so expensive then. But we got off and we drove from Ann Arbor to Detroit. And we went downtown Detroit to the Detroit Edison Building, and all 12 of us, we were going to protest nuclear energy. So we got out there and we had our signs, and we had a megaphone, and there wasn't hardly anybody there. But, that's the idealism. There's heartbreak, there's a sense of futility, but what else can you do? Because I sensed the direction of things with nuclear power. I don't know how or why, other than it just seemed like there was too much at stake. There was a liability cap for nuclear power accidents. That seemed kind of weird. Why wouldn't the company that's building the thing own the risk for it? There was never a plan there was not a plan at the time to store nuclear waste. Well, guess what, folks? What is this, 35 years later? There is still not a plan to deal with nuclear waste. It's sitting on sites, and many of those sites are near cities. And I just got this sense that when you're dealing with something as important as water, that the greatest of care should be taken. And now we've had Chernobyl, we've had Three Mile Island, and we've got Fukushima. And we have an entire body of nuclear power plants that are aging. And we just haven't really figured a way to deal with the nuclear cycle. After we've had it in place, and after we have all this. This keeps repeating itself. The experts for nuclear power at the time said it'll be safe. And they had no body of experience to draw upon. It was statistical tables. These were experts who, by and large, were bought and paid for by the nuclear industry. Kind of the same thing with the tobacco industry. They'd testify, they'd write reports, they said cancer, the tobacco was not addictive, they weren't adding anything addictive to the cigarettes, and they were they were not cancer-causing. Well, that was bullshit, we all know that now. Interesting thing, to tie it up on the corporate free speech thing, the state of Massachusetts passed a law that said that Camel Joe, the Camel cigarettes and the Camel cartoon character, could not be placed any closer than 1,000 feet to a school. That seems pretty reasonable. Came out that the tobacco industry had targeted 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds, because they had to create a new generation of smokers to sustain their profits. Kind of disturbing, isn't it? Corporate profits. Get those kids smoking. The people of Massachusetts passed laws. The trial courts of Massachusetts sustained challenges to those laws, banning and prohibiting those signs within 1,000 feet of school. And do you know what? Corporations are people. And those corporations' free speech rights were being violated. So, by the way, anybody aware that the ocean's being acidified by the coal burning? It's actually a bigger problem, a more immediate problem to fish habitat, I'm told by experts. At a conference last week, the global warming, acidification from coal. So as these coal trains go out, and as we export coal, as we try to do so, as we sell it to the companies, the people, the United States government, for $1 where it sells, at the end buyer for $120, remember that coal burning is another thing, along with the Fukushima radiation, which might undermine the ability to fish from the Pacific Ocean. Something to think about there. 1 minute. How about this one? Back to the trains. No less than 58 coal train derailments since between June of 2010 and August of 2013. By my calculations, that's 26 months. This is in the United States. That's right. I said 58 coal train derailments. One of those was in the Clark Fork of the Lewis River up there in Trout, Montana, and it became a Superfund site. So I guess in closing, I would just quote, I got a couple more points. I have to make this. We are just emerging from the Great Recession. We have not seen significant form of the financial industry so as to prevent another collapse of the investment banking, the housing industry, and the pillaging of retirement funds of hardworking Americans. And why not? This is because of corporate influence in the Congress, in federal agencies. The lobbyists and the power of money is infecting and destroying effective representation democracy in the United States of America. We need to pass this amendment to change the Constitution, to remove corporate personhood, to remove their constitutional rights. And in closing, I would just like to quote Justice Stevens in his dissent in Citizens United, joined by Justice Sotomayor and Justice Sotomayor and Justice Ginsburg. Corporations have no consciences, no beliefs, no feelings, no desires. Corporations help structure and facilitate the activities of human beings, for sure. And their personhood often serves as a useful legal fiction. But they are not themselves a member of we the people, by whom and for whom the Constitution was created. Thank you very much.
John Orr, attorney, musician, activist, on the value of activism. You've been listening to a selection of speakers from the Stand Up Stories event presented by the Clatsop County Democrats. We heard from Greg Delgado, a community activist from Causa, Oregon, on immigrant rights, Margaret Fremeth, Director of Lives in Transition on marriage equality, Josh Marquis, Clatsop County District Attorney on access to mental health in Clatsop County, and John Orr, attorney and musician on the value of activism.